Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
The night may be long and the dark may be deep, but the answers are there to be found. Whether it's the normal, the abnormal, or the paranormal, you're in the right place. Let's go beyond reality.
Sometimes it's the normal, sometimes it's the abnormal, and sometimes it's the paranormal, and sometimes it's just very strange, right? Trick or treat, everyone. It's Beyond Reality Radio on this trick or treatiest of all nights, Halloween. I hope everybody had a really, really great time. And if that those celebrations are continuing for you, that's awesome as well. But we have a great program lined up for you as we try to wind up our Monster Week with your monster stories. We are going to feature a number of our listeners who have contacted us ahead of time. We might have some room for calls later if you decide you want to share a story. But we have a bunch of listeners who have submitted stories to us, and they're going to share those stories with us, whether it's a UFO, a Bigfoot, a ghost story, whatever it happens to be, just an encounter with the paranormal. That's what we're going to do in the second part of the program. But the first part of the show is actually something that's very, close to my heart, I guess. I've always been a Harry Houdini fan. I think the story of his life is fascinating. I think the story of his professional career is also fascinating. I believe that he is one of the greatest showmen of all time, and it's not just because of what he was able to do with his tricks, but also because of the way he knew how to promote himself. We've all seen film footage of him hanging, upside down, 10 stories up, whatever it happens to be, getting out of a straitjacket or being put in a trunk, thrown into a river. I mean, the things he did were pretty amazing. But he also knew how to promote himself. But he also had a connection to the mystical. The mystical and the afterlife. He was a staunch searcher for answers. After his mother died, Harry Houdini set about finding a way to contact her, and he saw many, many mystics, psychics, mediums, whatever they claimed to be, all of whom said they could contact his mother for him. And he set about proving they were all frauds. And I think almost every single one of them he saw, that's what he ended up doing, proving that they were a fraud. But when it came his turn to die, he had one more trick left up his sleeve. And he worked out an arrangement with his wife. He said, if I can come back in any way, if I can communicate from the other side, I will. And here is what I will say. And they had a code that they had put together. And I think it's a code they had actually used back in vaudeville or during their early days in their career. And he said, I will. These are the words that I will say to you if, in fact, a medium can reach me and starts telling you that they're communicating with me. So our guest in the first hour of the program will be Professor Slim King. He is considered to be the world's foremost expert on the afterlife, the life after death of Harry Houdini. He says that message was delivered. There are documents that indicate it may have been delivered. And he's going to tell us all about the story. So we're excited about that. And then, like I said, in the second hour of the show, we will feature your paranormal stories. I don't know how long I can wear this. Those of you watching on our YouTube channel, I don't know how long I can wear this because my headphones won't fit under the hat. So it's a bit of a challenge because they keep wanting to fall off. But I did want to open the show, at least in the spirit of things. And if I had a good costume available, I would have worn that. But I didn't. It was last minute, as you can tell. Let's see. Stop by the YouTube channel if you haven't seen it yet or haven't subscribed. We'd love to have you do that. You'd be able to catch something as silly as what I'm wearing right now. You just go to YouTube and search for JV Johnson. Subscribe to the channel. Share it with your friends. There are about 400 back episodes of Beyond Reality Radio there. Plus, we stream live. If you can't pick up the program on a radio station in your market, then the YouTube stream is a great way to participate. Plus, There is a very vibrant chat room, which is now saying all sorts of funny things about the way I look, which I expected. You can't blame them. So do that. Also like us on social media, Facebook, it's Beyond Reality Radio, and also JV Johnson. Let's go to break because we have a lot to get to tonight. It's Beyond Reality Radio. We'll be right back.
Did you know that online retailers like Amazon have constant deals that can save you money on the things you buy every day? It's no joke. Save 40%, 50%, even 80% on great products. And all you have to do is know about them. Noodle Shark is the way to be alerted when something good is coming your way. Noodle Shark is the social media page that lists great deals that not only save you money, but give you the deals before anyone else has them. All you have to do is find Noodle Shark on Facebook. Search it as The Noodle Shark. That's The Noodle Shark, because you deserve to save too. Become a shark and save.
We've got a really great program lined up for you tonight. In the second hour of the show, we're going to feature your paranormal stories. Bigfoot, UFO, ghost, whatever it happens to be, you're the star in the second hour of the program. The first hour, however, we're going to talk about a story that has always, always fascinated me, and that's the story of Harry Houdini. Our guest in this first hour is Professor Slim King. He's had an interest in the supernatural his entire life. He's explored many paranormal events and conducted hundreds of psychic and other simply weird experiments. He's written several ebooks about the basics of numerology, palmistry, pendulums, dreams, dice, and other strange methods of telling the future. Slim actually predicted the Belmont Stakes Superfecta just a short while ago. And we never have an idea what he's going to predict next, but he's here with us tonight to talk about Houdini. Slim, welcome to Beyond Reality Radio. This is going to be a great conversation.
It is a fantastic evening. It's the anniversary of the 93rd anniversary of the passing of Houdini.
That's what it is, 93 years. What, was 1926? Is that what we're talking about?
Yes, 1926. October 31st.
What is it about Harry Houdini that 93 years after his death, you and I on a nationally syndicated radio show are still talking about him?
There are a lot of factors that play into this. I mean, he was the greatest guy at his time, but you think that he would just fade away after that was gone. You
right.
don't hear much about Thurston or any of the other guys that were equally as popular during that time.
Yeah, and there's been, you know, others since that have done what some may consider more amazing feats of magic or trickery, however you look at it. But something about Houdini, and I think the secret to it has to do with the way he was able to self-promote.
Yes, he was a really, really good self-promoter. And then part of it has to do with the Houdini code, strange enough, this afterlife experiment that he had with his wife, Beth.
Yeah, and we're going to get into that because that is a fascinating part of this story. But before we do, when Houdini died in 1926, now he died on Halloween of all nights. How old was he at that point?
Oh, boy, 48, I think. I can't remember exactly how old he was when he died.
But he was in his 40s.
Yes, he was in his 40s, and he was in excellent shape, a really, really good shape. He was a swimmer. He worked out. He would let these people punch him in the stomach after he insulted them or however he, you know, got their dander up to really get the promo going on his gigs. So he was in really, really good shape.
Well,
it,
I mean,
very odd that he would die.
Yeah, and he could hold his breath, you know, I don't know what the figure was, but certainly a lot longer than most people could, and he would practice that. As you said, he was completely in shape from head to toe, worked out all the time, and he had to be in shape to be able to perform the tricks, I guess, that he performed. He had to be in great shape to do that stuff.
Right. It was just amazing. I mean, the physicality of what he had to do, you know, to break out of the jail cells and all that. And he would, you know, they'd strip him down to next to nothing, you know, and he was pretty buff. And that was kind of the thing that, you know, there'd be pictures of him and he's, you know, 90% naked, you know, but he's all in chains and stuff. So it's got some real overtones, you know, that make you think, wow, he really had an ingenious advertising scheme going on.
Yeah, so let's talk about his death a little bit here, because when we have seen the movies, you know, what we see generally is that, you know, he's in his dressing room and he turns around and somebody gives him an unsuspected punch to the stomach, because he used to do that as part of his trick. He had such strong stomach muscles, he could tighten them up and take a punch, but he wasn't ready for it. He takes the punch. He ends up going to the hospital a little while later and he ends up dying there. Is that actually how it happened?
that is not really what the consensus is today, is that he had appendicitis and he died of peritonitis from a ruptured appendix. Now, whether it had ruptured before he got hit or after he got hit, I think it was just probably inflamed and it really hurt him when he got hit. But they did pay his wife double on the insurance back in the day. But the doctors today say that's not how it happened. He died, I think, about 10 days after he got punched. Wow. And the seven of those were in the hospital. He was like, he was really tough. It took him a long time to pass away. They didn't have the kind of medicines we have today, and there was no way to stop the infection.
So
they had two, maybe three operations, I think.
Oh wow! So he went into the hospital about a week before Halloween, then, right? So it would have been so like the 24th of October. Then he died on Halloween, which is very fitting because Houdini had a life full of curiosity of and connection to the afterlife and mysticism. Tell us a little bit about his fascination with that.
Well, he was in Europe when his mother passed away, and he was, I don't know if you could say he was a mama's boy, but he had his mother with him almost all the time. He just really loved his mom. And she passed away here in America while he was performing in Europe. And he said the day that he saw a spirit of her the night she died, but he just said it was a coincidence. He would always rack these things up to being coincidences. And so he was really, really interested in it. He always wanted to contact her, and he always wanted someone to tell him what was going on. And Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's wife did just that. Houdini was crying one night after she had done some automatic writing. She said it had come from his mother.
Now, just for those of you who don't know, automatic writing basically is a process by which the writer, the person with holding the pen, goes into a bit of a trance. And supposedly, someone from the spirit world connects to that person, and the words flow through that person and just flow to the hand of the person holding the pen, and that's where the words come from.
Yes, and they often write it right. They write it backwards because it comes through like a mirror. You have to look at it in a mirror to actually read it.
So she did that for Houdini, and it moved him. But did he ultimately believe that came from his mother?
Well, later he said that had to be just some coincidence, and she was reading me and something like that. And he was pretty good friends with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. There's pictures of them. The Houdinis and the Doyle family at the beach and stuff like that. They kind of hung around, and they were getting into radio because radio was big at the time, and both of them had their, you know, were coming from their different angles. A little while after that, he didn't have much to do with Sir Arthur, and they say it was because of this event of where the wife did the channeling of his mother.
So it was Houdini's mother's death that really made him start paying attention to this. And he was so desperate to make contact with her in the afterlife that he would go to medium after medium after medium. And it didn't take very long for him to recognize that he was actually parading through a bunch of hoaxes and frauds. And he kind of made it a bit of his life's work at that point to expose these people.
Right. Well, J.V., a lot of people don't know, and some of the movies have hinted at it, but at the very beginning of his career with Bess, they pretended to be spiritualists, and they had a spiritualist stage show that they traveled with. So he knew all the tricks that these mediums, the fake mediums, pseudo-mediums were using. He knew all of those. And so it was pretty easy for him to go in. And if they were using these tricks on him, he would know what was going on.
And he would expose them very, very publicly, too.
Yes, he would expose them. But towards the end of his career was waning a bit. And so he started adding this spiritualism part at the end of his show after the escapes. And he would go out into the community sometimes and expose these guys. But what people didn't know is that he had others that had went out before and kind of fixed the situation. If they couldn't figure out what the medium was doing that was wrong, or fakery, they would plant something on him. They would put something in the couch and pull it out, and it's an incandescent gown or something. So he was kind of cheating. If you read the conversations with Kreskin, he kind of describes what was going on.
We have just about a minute here, maybe a minute and a half before we have to go to break. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk specifically about what happened after Houdini's death, because that's really where the story gets very, very interesting. We're also going to talk a little bit about you, Slim, the work you've done. You've done a lot of stuff. You continue to do a lot of things. But before we get to that, would you say Houdini was the greatest magician of all time?
No. No.
Would you say he was the standard by which all magicians at this point measure themselves?
He was the most popular magician of all time. People talk about him now, but David Copperfield has probably played to many, many more people than Houdini did.
Right. Do you also think that he was a product of the time? I mean, when he was performing, people were, I would say, quite a bit more naive. They didn't have mass media to draw experiences from. They were limited to what they would see in their communities, basically, whether it was on stage or with their neighbors. They just didn't have exposure to the same things that we do today.
They were just starting to get into movies. As a matter of fact, Houdini made several movies when
That's right.
first started. He could have rivaled Universal or any of them, but he had other interests. He starred in every one of his movies. So they had vaudeville, and then it was turning into these movies, and he was right on the cusp of everything. It would have been amazing if he could have lived. You know, I think he would have set a lot of records that, you know, we'd be talking about him right now.
Was he making those movies in some kind of a partnership with Thomas Edison? Or am I off base on that?
I don't think so. I think he tried to get some information. Of course, those guys were always trying to find a scientific thing they could use for a trick, an effect.
Yeah.
And they were always, you know, talking to those guys. But I think he financed it all pretty much himself.
Gotcha.
And he did a thing they called the dailies, which they still use now. And he's the one who invented the dailies, the way to super fast process film and take a look at it that night.
Tell us a little bit about you. You've had your hands in a lot of different things that kind of circulate around this stuff we call mysticism and paranormal.
Yeah, I've been, you know, ever since a small child, interested in magic and wondering, hey, is there real magic? You know, is there really something out there that's magic? And so I, you know, started looking at this, reading these books, trying this. And even now, all the things that I've written, I still question the things that I've done, because I'm learning, constantly learning more and more and more. And I love it. I think that we need to all get a little spiritual. You know, I do believe in a life after this, and I kind of want to be in a good situation when I get there.
Let me ask you specifically, because you just said it, but I want to hear it again. Do you firmly believe, 100%, no doubt, in the afterlife?
Yes.
Is your experience with researching and studying this Harry Houdini incident help firm that belief for you?
This really solidified it for me, I think. I started studying this quite a while ago when I found this one document. But did you know that Harry had been cursed by the spiritualists?
I remember hearing something about that. Yeah, tell us what happened.
Yeah, in 1924, he went to a seance with Mina Crandon, and she was the Blonde Witch of Boston. And she was very, very famous. She didn't charge anything for what she did. She did these seances. And her spirit guide was Walter, her brother. Her deceased brother was the spirit. And Houdini had built this box to put her in so only her head and her hands could stick out, so there could be no funny business. And she got in the box and went into a trance, and then Walter came through, went into a rage, started cussing and swearing at Houdini, and said that Houdini had put something in the box. And they went and looked in the box, and they found that there was this ruler stuck in this box, hidden, as if they were trying to frame her. Like, remember I talked to you earlier about framing up, that they had put something in the box to make it look like she was trying to cheat.
Hmm.
And so Walter, the spirit, cursed Houdini to death. And within 2 years, Houdini was dead.
Wow.
So that curse, the spiritualists all knew about it, and they knew it was going on. Houdini used it in his advertising, and then he'd always say, well, you know, if I die, it's just a coincidence. It's just a coincidence, even before he died. It's a really spooky situation.
Yeah. Yeah, very spooky. So Harry Houdini's lying in the hospital bed. They're trying to do what they can to save him, but it doesn't look good. And he has a conversation with his wife, Bess. What do they say?
Yes.
What do they talk about?
They're going to talk about this afterlife experiment that they'd been working on. He always wanted to find. He was a skeptic, but he wasn't a pseudo skeptic. You know, he is open minded. He was, you know, prove me wrong. Here's $10,000. Prove me wrong. He was that kind of a guy. And so he and his wife had worked out one of the most, I think it's one of the ingenious afterlife experiments ever that I've ever heard of. And they had a code word, and then they had another word that was code word that they used the secret code. Each letter had a different word that coded that letter to spell out another word. And then this was a two-way code because they didn't know who was going to die first. And so she had 5 words in French that she would say back to him because Houdini wanted to know that if he was on the other side, that he was actually speaking to Beth. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely makes sense.
He had a two-way code. Most people just have one word or something. This was an intricate code that involved about 16 different words.
And they decided that whichever one of them had passed away first was going to do anything within their ability on the other side to communicate a message to the other, and the code was designed to make sure that there was, you know, the intermediary, the medium, if you will, was not able to pull any pranks.
Exactly.
So,
yep. And they,
yeah, go ahead.
They had devised a code between the two of them, and it was similar, but unlike any other code that they had used before. They said they had used it in vaudeville. When they were in vaudeville, but it was just similar. It wasn't the same code.
So there's a couple of things here at play. One is the code itself, which may not have been exclusive to Harry Houdini and Bess. Other people may have had some knowledge of that, but that doesn't mean they would have had knowledge of the message itself, right?
That's right. That's right. What did they would have to know what the code was supposed to spell. They would have to know the secret code word.
So, so Harry Houdini passes away. And when do the seances begin? When do they start trying to make contact with Harry Houdini?
Well, the rumor that later in 1936, they have what they called the final Houdini seance. And at that time, they said they had a seance every year for the last 10 years. But that wasn't true. That was just some hype for the movie. As far as I know, they only had like one other seance between after 26 to 36, or 29 to 36.
So between 29 and 36, you think they only had that final one in 36 and maybe one other?
Well, right now, there's probably 100
right.
Houdini
right.
seances going on around
That's right.
the United States and the rest of the world.
That's right. So after the fact, yes, obviously. So, but did they start having, did Bess or anybody start having these seances immediately after his death? Or did they wait a year? Do we have any knowledge of how that started?
Right. They say they did, but every historian that I've ever talked to cannot prove it. They can't prove that they don't know where, when, or anything about any seances other than this one in 1929.
Okay, first of all, before we talk about that seance, what is a seance? People go to mediums all the time and they get a reading. What's the difference between going and getting a reading versus a full-blown seance?
Well, a psychic is someone who taps into your psyche. They don't necessarily become a medium. A medium is someone who talks to the spirit world. A medium, like a telephone, is a medium between you and me, right? And so a medium is someone between you and the spirit world. A psychic can do your reading. They can look at your tarot cards, they can look at you, they can get a feeling about you and this and everything else, but they're not tapping into the spirit world to tell you about what the tarot card means.
Okay, so if I go to a medium, and we've had a lot of mediums on this program, and they will take calls, and they'll do, we call them readings, I don't know if they're necessarily readings, for people, and they'll make a connection, and they'll pass a message on, or whatever. But that's not necessarily a seance, right? Seance is a little more complex.
Well, some seances are very, very, very different. The seance, some people get 13 people in a circle, and they hold hands, and then one of them is the medium. They come out of the family circles. Back in the 20s and 30s, there were all these spiritualists that they were Baptists and Lutherans and Methodists, and on like on a Saturday or a Sunday, they'd get together at somebody's house, you know, in the middle of the day, and they'd get in these family circles, and one of the guys would be the medium and try to make a contact with their relatives.
So is it your belief that that's this the seance, the mother of all seances as it relates to Harry Houdini on January 8th of 1929, was that the only really what we'll call officially sanctioned seance by Bess Houdini?
No, she did one again in 1936 to promote the movie that was coming out.
Okay, right.
Right. So, but she... What got me started on this whole thing was I found this document that she had signed and a lot of other people had signed the day after the seance at her home.
All right,
January 8th.
Yeah, set up the seance for us because this, you know, let us know who's there and what they're trying to do.
There is a man, his name is Arthur Ford, and he's like the pastor or something of the spiritual church there in New York. And he has been holding seances with his congregation, and they've been trying to reach Houdini. Bess Houdini has a $10,000 reward out for anybody that can come up with this code. And they contact her and ask her to take that reward down because they think it's interfering with the communication. So that's the reason that she doesn't pay out when this code is cracked. So Arthur Ford says, I got it, has somebody from his church contact Bess, and Bess says, well, come on over, and we'll have the seance here. And so he goes over there. It's in the middle of the day. It's about noon. I think he probably puts on a pair of glasses or a towel or something over his eyes, one of those little masks. And he lays down, and he is what they call a trance medium. He goes to sleep. So he lays down on the couch, goes to sleep, and then he contacts his spirit world, and he starts talking to Bess. So that's the kind of seance with a trance medium. That's how that works. It can happen in the middle of the day. There's nothing spooky. People aren't really holding hands or nothing. He's just laying on a couch,
okay,
communicating with the other side.
And as he's doing this, and as he's communicating to Bess, he is communicating words from allegedly Harry Houdini. Does he give her the code?
Yes, he gives her the code exactly verbatim. He has a spirit guide over there. It's kind of like the operator for a telephone service or something. That's who he's communicating with, and that guy is communicating with Houdini. So it's kind of a three-way thing. That guy's telling...
Right.
The spirit, and the spirit's telling Arthur Ford. And so then Arthur Ford's just relaying this message across. And so he says, Rosabelle, answer, tell, pray, answer, look, tell, answer, tell. And she knows that that spells out the word believe.
Wow.
And so, and then she says, oh, and then she's like crying and everything. And then she says her five words in French, which I don't know exactly. I don't speak French, but it means I pull the veil back like as such. And that was one of her lines out of when she actually was on stage with Harry, working with him as his assistant at the very beginning.
So we know that her reaction was emotional. We have an account of that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. She had suffered a fall, and so she was kind of laying down on a couch, too. she was just laying there. In a way, you know, she always, in my opinion, was a, if she was hurt or something, she really dramatized it. She really pushed it, you mm-hmm. know, mm-hmm. and I think she'd fallen down like a week earlier. And so she was still laying there in bed like she was all, but she was up the next day and signed off on all these documents.
Yeah. So tell us about these documents. Why are they important?
This is really what got me started when I saw this. And then everybody said, no, that's not real. That's just a fake document. And then when I said, no, it's a real document. Well, that's not her handwriting. Well, no, my wife's a handwriting expert. That's her handwriting. Well, those aren't the people that were there. Yeah, they were there. And so do you want me to read what this says? It's a little document.
Yes, read the document.
Yes, and actually, this is a photocopy. They made these photostat copies back in 29, right? They took a picture of it and sent these pictures around, and they sent this thing to everybody. And this particular one was sent to Mina Crandon, the blonde witch of Boston.
Oh, wow.
From this guy named Francis Fast. And he later writes a book about the whole thing. So he gets this photocopy and sends it. It says, New York City, January 9th, 1929. So that's the day after. She says, regardless of any statements made to the contrary, I wish to declare that the message in its entirety and in the agreed upon sequence given to me by Arthur Ford is the correct message pre-arranged between Mr. Houdini and myself, signed Beatrice Houdini. And here's the really interesting part. It is witnessed by this guy named Harry R. Zander, Minnie Chester, and John W. Stafford. And that's the icing on the cake, because Harry Zander is the number one reporter in New York City at the time. He works for the United Press, so like the Associated Press. When he writes an article, hundreds and hundreds of newspapers get that article. He's one of the top guys, and he was an award-winning guy. His son was, and his grandson, even after him, were award-winning reporters.
Slim, this is really obviously very convincing. And where did you discover the document?
Well, I was just, I think I was on the Magic Cafe or something, and I was talking to these magicians, and they said something about Harry, and I just did a Google search, and I saw this thing, and I read it, and I said, what the heck is this? And that's when they all started backing off of the thing. And the bottom guy is John W. Stafford. He's the last guy to sign it. He is the head of the Scientific American, the magazine.
Yeah.
They had a $2,500 reward for someone who would do this. And Arthur Ford didn't take anybody's money.
Well,
he just didn't take anybody's money, and he just delivered it. And then I think he went on tour, you know, and just kept doing what he was doing because he was famous then. And what people don't know is if you go to the very top, the Houdini's Ghost on Facebook, the Des Moines Register that day has huge headlines. It says, Houdini proves soul immortal. And on the 9th of January, there were hundreds and hundreds of newspapers that had really, really similar headlines on the front page that Houdini had come back. And they were certain that it was genuine.
When we talk about this this seance in 1929 and Bess Houdini's statement that the message was delivered and it was accurate and it was all the right things, that whole thing does not come without controversy, though, does it?
Oh, she lost almost every one of her friends within the month. And she wrote a great letter to Walter Winchell, of all people, explaining her situation, that she was telling the truth, even though everybody else was saying it couldn't be because they were real skeptical of it. But she wasn't lying. So
was there a point at which, and I'm just doing this from memory here, I didn't really research it, but was there some controversy as to whether or not that message may have been printed somewhere?
They said that the code was printed in a book that was printed a year earlier, but that was a numerical code that she and Harry had used for a coin. They gave the date of a coin. She would guess the date of a coin, and he would code it to her. And in that code, answer, like pray was number one, and answer was number two, and mm-hmm. say was number three. Mm-hmm. So that code had been out there, but they never ever said
what the message.
The Houdini code had no numbers in it.
Right. That one instance that Bess Houdini has testified or certified she received the message, was that the only time that that connection was made, as far as you know?
Well, what I, yes, I think that was the only time. I think she thought that was going to happen all the time. And I want to clarify what we had talked about before, about you asked about if it had ever been written down.
Right.
Well, they had a $10,000 reward, and they did write down the code in its entirety, and they put it in the merchant's bank in a safety deposit box. And I think that's where they went the next day on the 9th after the seance, because she said, I will take you and we'll open it up and you can see for yourself. And I think they actually signed that document at the bank.
At the bank while they were looking at the code that had been stored there.
Right. So to go on it, all they had was what Bess had told them at the seance. This is the number one reporter. This is the guy from the Scientific American. So they go with her, and she brings it out of the vault and opens it up, and it's exactly what she said. And so they had that there for anybody who was trying to get the $10,000 to prove
right
or wrong.
Right, right.
So they had backed up their plan, and in 2011, they actually found it.
They found the document?
They found that document.
Wow.
And Magic Magazine wrote an article called Believing in Roosevelt in December of 2011. So they had found it in Texas. It was in a lawyer's, you know, a bunch of lawyer's stuff. And they went through there, and the guy goes, oh, my gosh, this is the Houdini code. And it's on display at some college there now.
That's pretty amazing. We're kind of out of time here, but this is a fascinating story. I appreciate you telling it for us and giving us the nuts and bolts of the whole thing. You're up to a lot of stuff. Where can people find out what you're doing? Maybe check out some more of your work.
SeeTheDead.com is a good place to go. It's Jim Callahan's site, and it's a pretty good site, and he adds me onto it. I don't really seek a whole lot of stuff. You can go to Houdini's Ghost on Facebook or Professor Slim King on there.
Great.
But I just like to do research, and I love talking on the radio. My hobby is doing magic on the radio, so sometimes we should try that sometime.
Well, you know what? That sounds like a great idea. You've been in contact with my producer, so we'll have to set something up. Listen, Slim, it's been fascinating. Have a great rest of your Halloween night. Thanks for being here, and we will definitely have you back on.
Yeah, it's All Saints Day. Let's go.
Before we start taking the calls, I did want to mention that it's kind of a last-minute thing, but I'm going to be in the Cleveland, Ohio area over the weekend at an event called Retro Invasion Weekend. It's at the Westlake, Ohio Doubletree Hotel. I'm going to be there Friday through Sunday. I'll be there with Jason Lively. You know him from European Vacation and Night of the Creeps. Plus, he's done a bunch of other stuff. So if anybody's in that area, look forward to seeing you there. All right, so one of the things that we like to do on this show is connect and communicate with people who have actually experienced the things that we talk about. Because not everybody that we have on the program has actually experienced what they may be an expert in. And we have a lot of listeners that have had their own experiences, and we're going to spend time tonight for the rest of our Halloween broadcast talking about that. So we're going to go to the phone lines, and our first paranormal experiencer is Carrie from Uniontown, Pennsylvania. Carrie, welcome to the program. Great to have you on.
Hi, good evening. How are you?
Terrific. Thank you very much for agreeing to do this. A lot of times these stories can be very, very personal and very emotional. I'm not sure if yours is either one of those, but why don't you go ahead and tell us what happened to you?
Okay. Honestly, I have been skeptical. I've been actually petrified of paranormal until I was 23, when my grandmother passed away in 2001. When we had the burial that night, she had come to me in my room, and she was in the corner of the room in the dress that we had buried her, that I know that she never owned because we had to buy that at the funeral home.
Wow.
And she, yeah. And I was, I sat up straight in bed and I was like, okay, I'm dreaming. This is not real. But she clearly said to me, she said, I have something for you. I need you to make sure you protect it and make sure that you keep it with you. And I, needless to say, I did not go back to sleep that night. And my dad had brought in jewelry from her the next morning. And I have a pair of her white gold and yellow gold earrings that I wear only on special occasions. And I wore them for my wedding. And I know that she was with me. And it just made me more open to know that there's greater things on the other side that we don't understand. When I started at working at Brownsville Hospital at a local hospital 2 years later, we more than I had experienced the same apparitions and the same experiences. There were a lot of employees that had the same things that I had done. We were working on the psych ward, which, you know, as a lot of people know, people don't sleep at nighttime.
Yeah.
On a psych ward, they don't sleep at night, and it's normal. I was not allowed to leave the middle of the hall because there had to be somebody there at all times. And we had a patient that was actually very ill while the other two nurses were taking care of another patient. I was sitting in the middle of the hall, and an ice-cold wind went right through me, and I was not able to get up out of the the middle of the room. And I was, and then 2 minutes later, as soon as they came out of the other room, I said, okay, we have to go in that room, and the patient was deceased.
Oh, wow, Carrie.
So obviously that was the soul coming through me.
Yeah, let me just tell you something very, very quickly, and then I've got to move on. But when my mother passed away, she was in the hospital. She'd been in the ICU for 4 days. And I sat with her the whole time. And the morning that she ended up passing away, I was standing next to her bed, holding her hand, watching the monitor. You know, you watch all the numbers, you know what's happening. And when it, you know, when it, the end came, I was standing there and a cool breeze out of nowhere. I'd been there for 4 days, did not feel a breeze one time. A cool breeze came across my face, and it almost brought me to tears, and it almost still does, because I knew exactly what was happening. Carrie, thank you so much for sharing that story. Let's go to Chris. Chris is in Cache, Oklahoma. I think I want to live in Cache, Oklahoma, Chris. I like that name.
Nice little town.
I like that name.
I like living here.
Chris, what's your story about?
Well, I lived next door to my grandparents whenever I was a kid, and when my before my grandfather passed away, I had a car that broke down, and it broke down for a couple of days, and my grandfather got tired of it sitting there, so he made me go out there and work on it with him. Well, after he passed away, I had bought a truck, and it ran good for a while, and then one day it broke down, and it sat there for a couple of days, and I was asleep, and in my dream, my grandfather came over and said, "Hey, get up and let's go fix this thing." And I remember in the dream that we went out there and we worked on it. And this is a time that I had sleep apnea really bad, and I hardly had any dreams because I wasn't getting deep sleep to, you know, actually dream.
Yeah.
So it was kind of weird for me to have that dream. When I woke up, I forgot all about it until I walked out. And I usually walk past the truck to get to my other vehicle I had. Well, I noticed the hood was popped up, you know, like you just pulled the hood latch and it popped up. And I thought that was kind of weird, and I remember the dream. Well, I thought that was kind of weird, so I got in it, and it started right up.
Wow.
Yeah, and I'd never had any problems with it ever again.
Wow. So do you think that maybe your grandfather was directing you and you actually did something in your sleep, or do you think there was something more mystical going on and you just happened to be aware of it in your dream?
I don't know. It just got me more interested in paranormal. I don't think I really did anything in my dream because, you know, I didn't have the marks of grease and everything else on my hands.
Yeah, you would have noticed that. Yeah, you would have noticed that. Wow, that's a great story. Did your grandfather ever appear to you in any other way after that?
I would only have brief dreams of them coming back from like a vacation because they like to go places, and I always just felt like they were, you know, just visiting, stopping by, and making sure everything was okay.
Right. Well, that's a great story, Chris. Thank you so much for sharing it with us, and good luck to you. And I'm glad you're now on the believer side of things. Let's go to Terry. Terry is in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hi, Terry. Welcome to the program.
Hi, JB.
Thank you for being willing to share your story with us. Is your story ghost-oriented?
Yes,
Tell us the story. What happened?
Well, back in 1982, December 1st, my husband and I, we had just moved to East Tawas, Michigan. There used to be a Wurzburg Air Force Base up there. My husband was an Army recruiter. But we moved into this house. It was a tiny little house, maybe 700 square feet. And we met the landlord there, and the house was furnished. And he asked if he could leave the furniture in the house. He was renting it for his aunt, who had moved out. She'd just taken her personal items, and that was all. And we were only married maybe 3 years, and I had a one-and-a-half-year-old son. And so we moved in. And the first night we were there, my husband went to bed because he had to go to work the next morning. And my young son went to sleep. And I was unpacking things in the kitchen areas, kitchen, living room were together. I was getting tired, and I thought I'd lay down on the sofa for a little bit, you know, rest my ass because I was kind of tired, but I want to get stuff done. When I was laying down, I heard things moving around, and I thought my husband got up and walked out and was looking for something. And when I opened my eyes, there was an old man standing next to me wearing a flannel shirt, the suspenders, and he had one of those tubes in the nose, you know, like
oxygen tube?
Yeah, an oxygen thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he was looking at me. He kind of looked confused, and I was just staring at him. And I could he really wasn't solid, but he wasn't. You know, you could tell it was the colors and everything. Well, I closed my eyes, and I opened them again. And when I opened them again, he had his face right next to my face.
Oh, wow.
Just a couple inches away.
Wow.
And I closed my eyes really tight. And I don't know if I said to go away or I don't want to see you or something. And I just laid there with my eyes closed for the longest time. And when I opened my eyes again, he was gone. So I went to bed. Got up in the morning and told my husband what happened. He didn't believe me, but told him what happened. And I said, I think someone died in this house. And he goes, no, I don't think so. So we went down to the landlord's house after he got off work that day. And he invited us in. And he said, came in and I wanted to tell him what happened. And I said, did someone die in this house? And he goes, why? And I started telling him the story. And I was looking around his house and he had a fireplace on the mantle with pictures on it. And as I was telling what happened, I pointed out a picture and there was this old man and he was wearing a flannel shirt, kind of like what he was wearing.
Right.
And I said, that man right there, that's the guy I've seen in your house. And he turned white and he goes, that's my uncle. He died in that house. He said he went to the mailbox one day. He was coming back. And as soon as he came back in the house, he had a heart attack and had died. And he goes, and that's the reason my aunt moved out, because she kept seeing him and he kept turning on the TV.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So, but he looked at me, he says, look, he says he was a very nice man. I don't think he would, you know, cause any harm or anything. If, you know, I understand if you want to move, but we never did. We stayed. And I didn't see him anymore. I guess he decided I didn't want to see him and he wasn't going to show himself. But we could hear things move around in there at night.
Right.
And sometimes dishes would be put on the counter or things would be put in a different spot. But his bedroom was the same bedroom as my son. And we could hear somebody talking in there sometimes. And my son was giggling and laughing and carrying on.
Hmm.
So I guess my son liked it too. But
yeah.
If something happened every day that we were in that house, but I never seen him after that particular day.
Wow. That's kind of story that sends shivers down my spine. Thank you so much, Terry, for sharing that one with us. You know, that's often a bit of a quandary. You know, the closest people to me that have passed away are my parents, and all rather recently. And I'm mixed whether or not I want to open my eyes someday and see one of them standing there. I mean, my heart says, yeah, I'd really like that. But it's also kind of frightening. And I suppose it shouldn't be. I suppose it should be comforting. But I guess it depends how they appear to you would make a difference as to whether or not it's comforting or frightening. We have a little fun. If you're watching the YouTube stream, you know exactly what we're talking about. If you're not, you should go to YouTube and subscribe to the channel. It's just JV Johnson. You'll find it easily. We stream the show live there in case there's not a radio station in your market carrying the program. We prefer you do listen by a local radio station. That's the best way. But the YouTube channel is there for you if you don't have that option. Plus, there is an archive of about, 400 or so back episodes of Beyond Reality Radio on the YouTube channel for your enjoyment. So as we promised in the last hour of this particular show, the Halloween show, we're featuring your paranormal stories. And I just want to tell a quick anecdote here, because one of the things I find most interesting about being in this line of work, particularly the ghost part, is I'll be wherever and someone will come up to me and they'll say, yeah, I don't believe in any of that stuff. I don't believe in it. But let me tell you what happened to me when I was 14 years old. And then they proceed to tell me they saw a vision or an apparition of someone that they lost, which I always scratch my head, because if you had that experience, well, how can you still be a non-believer? And a few of our people tonight, the few of the stories we've already talked about, kind of fall into that category, although they ultimately became believers, it seems. So, interesting stuff. All right, let's go to our next listener caller. This is Aaron in San Diego, California. Aaron, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. So, are you enjoying your Halloween?
We are. Our neighborhood goes a little crazy. We handed out about 100 pounds of candy.
How much? What now? You gave out 100 pounds of candy?
We stole all of my kids' candy back to give to the last trick-or-treaters that were staggering through.
Oh, wow. All right. Well, so let's talk about your paranormal story. And make sure you're right up to your phone so we can hear you real well. What happened? Tell us your story.
So story is not really the right word. I just have ghosts.
Oh, you
They're
do?
Here all the time.
In your house?
Part of our family.
In your house?
All the time. Mm-hmm.
Really?
Two that are nice. One that we have to say goodbye every once in a while. Actually, my friend left Sage. She must have been a little spooked out tonight. I got to ask her what happened. But I found Sage on my fireplace before she left. So must be time to sage the house again. But the other two never leave. But the other one does. He goes away when we tell him to.
How long have you been experiencing this in your home?
So the first one I had, actually, it's funny because it made a non-believer a believer, was I was a teenager. And you're laying in bed, and I mean, obviously classic movie stuff. The door started shaking, a sweater fell off, and we freaked. We ran outside, and we had our buddy and one of our guy friends. We're like, hey, you know, this is what's happening. Hey, he joked back, what do you want me to do? Go after a ghost? And we're like, I don't know, just make it stop. Well, next day, he got my buddy, opened the door, stood in the hallway, full body apparition. My buddy jumped around the corner to scare who he thought was his cousin. And nobody was there.
Wow.
So that was the first one.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, not long after my stepdad passed, was when the second nice one showed up. Honestly, probably within about a week.
Hmm. You talk about this like it doesn't bother you.
It doesn't. Actually, the one that kind of creeps everybody out, he crawls into bed next to me. He doesn't touch me. He doesn't mess with anything, but you hear the bed creak, you feel the difference, you feel the change.
Yeah, you can feel that.
Move, and yeah. I tell him to stay on his side of the bed and I go back to sleep.
Do you have any idea who these spirits are?
I believe one is my father-in-law. Mm-hmm. I had him for, he's the one I've had since a teenager. I've known my husband since we were in high school together, so I do believe that's him. He only shows himself to guys, and he's quite the prankster. So, and also nicer looking females. He'll play with their hair. He'll mess with their jackets, stuff like that. So we do believe that's my father-in-law. And then the other one I do believe is my stepdad. And that's a smell relation. That's my stepdad.
Have you ever had an opportunity to catch any video or photographic evidence or anything like that? Do you bother with any of that?
The problem is we don't have an Alexa. We don't have a Ring or whatever that doorbell is with the little camera thing.
Yeah, right.
I've never even listened to the podcast. Never.
Wow.
So we don't, I mean, I've got pictures of when handprints are left, like, on the mirror when you get out of the shower. We've got pictures of, actually, my mom, she got it real good. My mom was like, oh, stop with that. I don't have time for that today. And she left footprints in oil across my mom's blanket. It's like one of those, like, 70s white, like, summer blankets that were on everybody's bed.
Right.
And, yeah, the footprints were clear as day. We all put our foot on top of it to show it wasn't any of ours. And my mom was like, all right, then. I take back everything I've ever said.
Wow. Well, I love your good-natured attitude toward all of this. And it seems like you're taking it in stride. It doesn't seem to bother you. You know what to do if they become a nuisance, and you're handling it pretty well.
Yep. I mean, now he's actually reacting to TV shows, which is ironic. That's actually what kind of made me reach out to you guys. He reacted to Ghost Nation a few days ago.
Oh, really?
The local, you know, paranormal, not Jason or any of them, asked, was that you knocking? Mm-hmm. And right on cue, knock, 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 right on our front wooden door. And we have a routine here. We all go, not it, not it, not it. Not saying that we didn't do it. We all know that it was our ghost.
Well, no wonder the
ratings. Even my 9 and 7 year olds are used to it.
Wow. Well, no wonder the ratings for Ghost Nations are doing so well. We've got a spirit audience as well. That's great.
That's it. You guys have reached everybody. I love it.
That's great. Aaron, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. We have to move on so we can get to everybody, but that was awesome. And again, I really, really like the fact that you're taking it all in good stride and it doesn't seem to scare you, which is the key here. All right, let's go to Clint. Clint is in Johnstown, Ohio. Hey, Clint, welcome to the program.
Hey, JV, thanks for having me.
Thank you for agreeing to tell us your story. First of all, did you have a good Halloween?
Yeah, it wasn't bad at all. The weather is pretty crappy here tonight.
Yeah,
a lot of high winds, rain, a little bit of snow, flurries.
Yeah, we're getting the winds and rain here in Cooperstown, upstate New York now, and I know it came through there first. You say you're getting a little bit of snow now too?
It's real light. It's just kind of like blowing around a little bit. It's nothing that's sticking or anything like that. It's
now,
very little.
Now, of all the paranormal stories I've heard tonight, that one is the scariest, that we're seeing snow here.
So, right? We're at least 2 months away from this stuff.
I would say so. So tell us your paranormal story. What happened?
Okay, so this is last Saturday. So a couple nights before that, a friend of mine called me pretty scared from something that he believed that he saw the night before. He described to me as coming up out of his kitchen floor. He said it looked like a bull, but like with skin on it. So it looked more like a person with two turned down horns.
That's
coming up out of his floor.
Yikes.
Which is, yeah, well, exactly. Now, I don't know that I really believe he saw that specifically. I believe that he saw something because he was definitely scared. There's no question that he saw something. And he's a guy I've known him since he was born. So I know the type of person that he is. So I researched a little bit. You know, only thing I could find even close to kind of what he was describing was like a minotaur type, you know, figure.
Yeah, right.
And he said that was not it. It did not look human enough in the face, which still kind of freaks me out a little bit because most things like that are, if you look it up, depending upon what you believe, are supposedly like a warrior for the devil. So it was sketchy, but, you know, he's a good friend, so we're going to go over there and try to investigate.
Jeez, be careful.
It was like a... Go ahead, sorry.
I just said, geez, be careful.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, you got to be smart. You can't be stupid. You got to know what you're doing and just, you know, do it right.
Are either of you religious at all?
Yes, well, my wife and I... are both Christians.
Okay. So you believe in the protection of the Bible and the crucifix and those things?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, that's handy. Absolutely. That's good. That's good, yeah.
Yeah. And I think one of the keys, too, is, you know, don't go into any situation like that and try to be or act negative. Just stay positive. Give your vibe off as a positive vibe no matter what. And, you know, that I think, in my opinion, helps a little bit as well.
Yeah.
But we went over there and, you know, did an investigation right off the bat. You know, we're asking questions. And I do a lot of burst EVP sessions. So only two, three, maybe 4 minutes long, and we review them right away as soon as we're done. So we get in there, and we sit down, talk to them a little bit, and I did ask them, you know, if either one of them uses an Ouija board, and they both said no. I felt immediately a little bit better after that. But we're doing EVP. I actually hear a voice with my own ears. We caught it on the recording, and it also hears, you know, you can hear me reacting to actually hearing it.
Wow.
Yeah, so I thought that was very impressive, in and of itself.
For sure, yeah.
So the night, you know, this is in the afternoon as well, so it's not like it's at night. We're just, it's like a pre-investigation to see if something we're going to bring, you know, our whole team in on, mm-hmm. or give advice, what's the next step. So we do the EVP sessions and stuff like that, and, you know, caught a little bit here and there, nothing. I never felt once that anything negative was there. Couple cold spots type thing, but it was like not, you know, didn't feel anything negative. So we're getting ready to wrap up. I do one last session, only like a minute and 20 seconds long. And as I'm doing this session, my wife and I are sitting on a couch, and our legs just get ice cold. We can't really get up. If you look at the thermostat in the house, and the furnace was off, so nothing was on or running. You look at the furnace in the house, the temperature went from 68 to 63, and I don't know, 10 seconds or less.
Wow.
Then it started to lighten up. I asked my wife to go stand in the spot where he claimed that he saw something come out of the floor. So she went and stood in that exact spot that he pointed out. And she said it felt like something pushed her out of the way.
Oh, geez.
When she got there, turned around, and that happened. She came back, sat down next to me. Next thing you know, everything feels back to completely normal, and the temperature goes back from 63 to 68 in a matter of seconds. Wow. As well.
Clint, we have about 15 seconds here. What's the final resolution? Have you done any more with this?
I did get another EVP from there. That it's a real deep, gargly voice that says, get out. Not get out, but give up.
Give up.
Yeah, we haven't been there back since. I've been in contact with my friend, so he wants to get my whole team in there. So that's our next step.
All right. Well, if you do us a favor, you do have Slick Eddie's contact information to set this up. Let us know what happens. If you get more data or more experiences there, we'd love to hear it. But thank you for sharing that story with us. Let's go to Julie. Julie's in Kentucky. Hi, Julie. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Hey, did you have a nice Halloween, Julie?
Yes, we did. It's a little chilly, but we had quite a few trick-or-treaters.
Did it start out chilly, or did you experience this warm, then cold, massive drop in temperature like a lot of the nation did?
Yes, it was not very nice this morning, mm-hmm. and then by this afternoon, it was windy, rainy, snowy. It was
crazy day.
Halloween.
Crazy day. Tell us your story, Julie.
Okay, when I was younger, we lived in a house in the country. And occasionally I would be playing. I was about 8 years old when this happened. You could kind of see, you know, things out of the corner of your eye or, you know, nothing real crazy. But one night I woke up and standing in my doorway was, all I could see was the face. And it was like a bald-headed man. And he had black eyes. And his ears were pointy, and he had, like, all of his teeth were pointy. And it was like he was just standing there staring at me. And, of course, I just shut my eyes real quick and just kind of fell asleep back again. But it wasn't too long after that we moved. And come to find out later on, Mother had told me that we had moved because she was afraid of the house. She had been out one night. And Daddy and I were at home, and when she came home, every light was on in the house, and there was music playing, and when she went to touch the doorknob, everything just went silent.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, and she came in, and we were asleep, and she didn't tell me this until years later, but once I had gotten married, and we were in our own home, my husband was working third shift, and I woke up, and the same thing was in my bedroom again.
Same bald-headed, pointy ear, pointy teeth?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. And that's when kind of things started happening around the house.
This was a different house or same house?
Yes, this was a different home.
Different house, okay.
Little things would happen, you know, just small things would be moved, just, you know, insignificant things that only I would notice, or I would walk by our spare bedroom and the door would come open. My husband tried to, he's like, oh, it's probably a loose floorboard, and he would try to walk back and forth in the hallway and it would never come open for him. And just little things, you could hear footsteps. And then finally, I just got scared enough that I contacted my pastor. You know, you don't know whether to reach out to people or not.
Right.
Sometimes they'll believe you, sometimes they won't.
Exactly.
And we prayed about it, and he suggested that we go through the house and anoint the house with olive oil. And we did that, and we just kind of, just things that I felt led to touch, you know, when we would go through the house, and we left the living room for last, and I'd had the door propped open, and I was like, okay, he just told me to ask it if it wanted to tell me something. If not, it was not welcome in my home, and now it needed to leave. And after that, nothing happened again.
So wait a minute. Give us a time context here. When did you have that second sighting of the bald-headed man? How long ago was that?
I was probably 22 at the time, so it's been about 20 years ago.
Okay. And then how long after you had that sighting did you go through this ritual whereby you haven't seen him since? Was it immediately after?
It was probably about, I'd say, a year and a half later. Things had just gotten to where, like, you'd wake up in the night and the lights would be on, or I knew I had locked the front door and my husband would come home and it would be unlocked. Just little things were starting to happen that I was just getting so scared that I finally reached out for help.
Yeah, okay. We're out of time here, but that's another one of those stories. I'm glad it had the resolution it did, and hopefully it stays that way for you, because I don't know if that's dangerous or not, but it's certainly disturbing, and I can understand why you'd be concerned about that. But Julie, thank
Absolutely.
You. Yeah, Julie, thank you so much for sharing that story with us and calling.
All right, thank you.
All right, everyone. Hope you had a great Halloween. Thank you for being here. Tomorrow night is a best of program. Monday night, we'll be back with Maria Goodevich. Goodevich? Yeah. She's a New York Times best-selling author. We're talking about dogs who can detect cancer, diabetes, and other health concerns from her book called Dr. Dogs. It's Beyond Reality Radio. Have a great weekend.
Beyond Reality Radio is hosted by Jason Hawes and JV Johnson and produced by Alexandria Johnson and Slick Eddie Edwards for Entercom Radio. Beyond Reality Radio is distributed by Westwood One Radio Networks. Stop by our Facebook page and say hello. Follow the hosts on Facebook as well. For Jason Hawes, follow at jasonhawes.taps. For JV Johnson, follow at jvjparanormal. If you'd like to be a guest on Beyond Reality Radio, or you have a suggestion for a guest, contact Slick Eddie Edwards at slickeddieedwards@gmail.com. Be sure to visit our chat room as well at beyondrealityradio.com. Thanks for listening.